The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And I am your host, Soraya, as always. And tonight, we are going to be talking to Ken Gerhard, author of Encounters with Flying Humanoids, Mothman, Man-Birds, Gargoyles, and Other Winged Beasts. And for some reason, that kept playing. All right. And, yeah, Ken, are you with us?
I am. Good evening, Soraya.
All right. Still having a couple technical problems here for some reason. All right. Well, how are you doing tonight?
I am doing terrific. How about yourself?
Aside from the technical issues, I'm doing great. We just got torrential rain here, which is better than the torrential snow that it could have been.
Yeah, well, you got to have a certain amount of rain during the course of the year, don't you? Or everything just kind of dries up and dies.
True. All right. So why don't you tell people a little bit of how you got into studying this stuff?
Oh, well, when I was a very young boy, probably about 8 or 9 years old, I remember watching a television show about Bigfoot, and I thought it was utterly fascinating, of course, as many young boys do. And, you know, at that time, it was back in the late 1970s, there was no internet or anything. So basically, I went down to the library and just checked out every book I could find on the subject of mysterious animals. And as I got older, my mother was very encouraging of my interest, and she was also a travel agent, so she loved to travel around the world to all these amazing and exotic places. And fortunately for me, she would take me along sometimes, so I found myself at a young age traveling to South America, camping along the Amazon River, and Australia, Africa, Asia, all these amazing places. And wherever I would go, I always had a keen interest in the local legends of mysterious creatures and legendary beasts, things like that. And so when I was 15 years old, my family vacationed at Loch Ness in Scotland. So I had an opportunity to attempt my first field research, you know, into the Loch Ness Monster at a very young age. And so it's something that's been with me my whole life, very passionate about. Certainly didn't plan on making a career out of it at any point, just something I was always pursuing. But about 15 years ago, I began doing a lot of field research, Bigfoot primarily here in North America, and I got to know a lot of remarkable people, and things have just kind of gone from there. So, I feel very blessed to have the opportunities I've had to go out and investigate some of these great iconic mysteries in the field of cryptozoology.
All right, and this isn't your first book. What was published before this?
Technically, it's my fourth book, although my first book was kind of a self-published pamphlet, and I don't think there are many copies out there anymore. But so we'll say it's my third book. I wrote a book called Big Bird, Modern Sightings of Flying Monsters, and that does not refer to the Sesame Street character in any way. It's a completely different Big Bird, but it's basically a giant flying creature that's been reported here in my home state of Texas since the 1970s. And then in that was in 2007, I believe. And then in 2010, I co-authored a book with my good friend Nick Redfern, who also lives here in Texas. And we wrote a book called Monsters of Texas, which was just kind of a regional book that covered a variety of things we had investigated here in the state. And so I guess technically this is my third book, and it was just released in September of last year, but I'm real excited about it.
Having read it, I can say it's a very excellent book. I highly recommend anyone who's interested in the subject. It's very well written. It's entertaining to read, which isn't always the case. I mean, some books are filled with information, but they're not necessarily an entertaining read. And as I told
you.
I feel like you and Nick Redfern are the people I feel are closest to writing the style and the feel that John Keel used to have when he wrote.
Well, thank you very much. I take that as a great compliment. Keel, of course, is a legendary figure in terms of the Mothman mystery, very iconic, and certainly influenced me as a young boy. I remember my mother, who really nurtured my interest in this stuff, I remember her sitting me on her lap, and occasionally she would tell me about the Yeti, but one of her favorite things to tell me about was the West Virginia Mothman. That's what she called it. And so I remember discovering Keel's books at a young age, and like most people who've read that book, I mean, it was kind of a life-changing experience. If you're into kind of the weird and the unexplained, it's such an amazing mystery and multifaceted with all these different layers of conspiracies and UFOs and Men in Black and just all these amazing elements. And the way Keel, you know, kind of lays it out, it's... you know, he kind of takes you on quite a journey. Now, that being said, of course, many people have seen the movie with Richard Gere that was spun off of the book, and it's not a bad movie, but I think people really need to read that book to get the whole experience.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I liked the movie. I liked what they did with it. I thought the feel was there, but it's so different from the actual events.
I mean, there's so many things that happened, and you know, certainly it's always difficult to condense all of that into a movie, I would imagine, into an hour and a half or whatever, but the book is awesome.
Yes, the book is absolutely awesome. It was the first thing I ever read for Keel, and I just sought out every one of his books after that. Was never disappointed.
Right. Yeah, he read quite a few. Strange Creatures from Time and Space was another one that I really like, and it's, of course... talks about the Mothman and some of the other strange creatures that Keel investigated. But he did author a number of very good books on a variety of subjects.
All right, so let's get into your book. What made you start researching flying humanoids?
Well, I mean, truth be told, I've obviously, like I said, it's been a lifelong interest, but... in the Big Bird book, my first book, I think I covered some cases that kind of crossed the line a little bit into the flying humanoid phenomenon. There seems to be a lot of ambiguity with regard to reports of flying creatures sometimes. That's something you find when you get into this stuff. But I would say in 2009, or maybe it was 2009, 2010, I flew down to Mexico to do a TV show called Monster Quest. And for that particular episode, they had me investigating reports of Mothman-like creatures down in Mexico, and there were many videos that had been showing up on YouTube of these, not really Mothman per se, but these human-like figures that were seen to be flying around high up in the stratosphere. So, that kind of really piqued my interest, particularly, looking at the big picture and realizing that the Mothman phenomenon is not necessarily... restricted to Point Pleasant, West Virginia, but it is a global phenomenon. It's been going on for a long time. And then in, I believe, 2011, the next year, another TV show flew me up to Point Pleasant to do a story on the Mothman for a show hosted by William Shatner. And so I actually had an opportunity to go to Point Pleasant and into the TNT area and really get a sense of what that community was like and how it was impacted. And a year or two later, I met a lady from Lou Ellen Publishing, and they, of course, have done a number of really good books on ghosts and hauntings and psychic phenomenon and things, and they wanted to get into cryptozoology a little bit. And so they had me drop some proposals for a few different book ideas, and they really liked the flying humanoid idea best. And I'm very happy with the fact that they selected that and gave me an opportunity to research that for a few more years. And that's kind of how it all came about. And in my opinion, there had never really been a full-blown compendium of the flying humanoid reports. You found little bits, other than Mothman prophecies, which was really just about the Mothman. You find bits and pieces and articles and other books on the unexplained or cryptozoology or, different places like that. But to put them all together in one book, I thought would be a valuable resource for people that were wanting to kind of dig deeper into the mystery.
Okay, well, let's talk about the Mothman a little bit. One of the things you mentioned is that one of the original witnesses, Linda, had changed her story a lot as time went on.
Yeah, Linda Scarberry is probably one of the most well-known Mothman eyewitnesses. she, along with her her husband at the time, Roger Scarbury, and another couple, Steve and Mary Mallett, had this remarkable encounter on November 15, 1966. And they were out in this remote area called the TNT area, so named because back during World War II, explosives like TNT were being manufactured for the war effort in this area. But it was, and by 1966, it was abandoned. It was basically a local hangout for teenagers, kind of in a wooded area. And they were driving around one night on a cold night in November, and suddenly they saw this Mothman creature, and it apparently chased their car, and as they sped away, and it chased them all the way back to the town of Point Pleasant, a few miles down the road. Terrified them to the point where they went in and filed a report with the local sheriff's office. And once the story hit the newspapers the next day, Mothman became an international star, so to speak. But Linda Scarbury, for years and years, was really the only witness from that particular incident that would come forward and speak about it. And she did a number of interviews for different TV shows, and people like Lauren Coleman got to know her very well. But through the work of a researcher named Andy Colvin, and Andy Colvin's an interesting figure. He is a gentleman who's written five now, really impressive books on the Mothman phenomenon, and he's from that area. And he actually refers to himself as the Mothman's photographer because he believes he may have captured an image of the Mothman at one point.
Well, we had Andy on back in January to talk about Mothman.
Very, very passionate about the subject matter and so forth. But anyways, he's, of course, being in that area, has had the opportunity to track down and interview a lot of these people. And, reading Andy's research, I was able to discern that Linda Scarbury, you know, her story had evolved or changed through the years. So I don't know if that was a result of maybe, you know, her perception changing or, John Keel, may have perhaps taken a little bit of license with her story initially, or maybe the newspapers as well. So it's hard to really say exactly what happened. That's one of the interesting aspects of the case this many years down the road, is that, you know, our perception of what may have transpired there has really changed.
How many Mothman witnesses were there overall, do you know?
Well, Keel claimed that he interviewed over 100 Mothman eyewitnesses, but many of them didn't want to come forward. They were, you know, understandably worried about being criticized or ridiculed and even harassed by Men in Black, who were apparently bumping around the town of Point Pleasant for about a year harassing people, telling them not to talk about it. So, I think, you know, as far as like what's been publicly documented in newspaper articles and different things, I think it's safe to say there's probably been about 30 or so Mothman witnesses that, you know, have gone on record and whose story has been told in different from different sources.
And what's the general description that's given?
Well, Mothman is a really creepy and bizarre creature, according to the descriptions. There's really nothing that comes to mind that could actually explain it. It's, basically stepping right out of a science fiction movie. It is a man-like form standing about 6.5 feet tall, dark-colored with kind of giant bat-like wings. Most people have described it as being either headless or having a very low-slung head that's hard to discern. But the most startling feature of the Mothman are its giant red glowing eyes. All the eyewitnesses commented that it had these enormous red glowing eyes that had sort of a hypnotic effect over people and really put them in a trance. Very sturdy man-like legs, no arms. One eyewitness named Marcella Bennett actually got very close to it, and she described it as being kind of a gray-colored and so forth. So, but generally speaking, most of the descriptions were very, very similar.
Okay, and the red eyes are also a feature in a lot of monster encounters.
Yeah, it's interesting you point that out. But you know, there have been a lot of accounts of other cryptids, and for those of you listeners that aren't familiar with the term cryptid, it's kind of a term we use in the field of cryptozoology to describe an uncatalogued creature. There have been reports of Bigfoot-type creatures with red glowing eyes, black panthers, other flying creatures. So yeah, that does seem to be a common motif. It's very interesting.
And it wasn't just the Mothman that was happening at this point. As you pointed out, there were Men in Black, and there were also a lot of UFO encounters going on, or a lot of UFO sightings, plus the whole Indrid Cold thing. Do you want to get into that mm-hmm. a little bit?
Well, I didn't really get into the Indrid Cold thing too much in my book. I think that was kind of covered very well by Keel and also by Gray Barker. And Gray Barker was a close friend of John Keel's. He was a UFO researcher and really convinced Keel to go to Point Pleasant and to investigate the Mothman mystery. So that's kind of an angle. And, you know, they discuss in the movie as well. But in terms of the UFO sightings, I mean, I was able to go through many, many newspaper archives from that area for the year that Mothman was presumably being sighted and reported. For about the first month, there were many, many sightings and accounts in the newspapers, specifically of the Mothman, and sometimes being seen in conjunction with strange lights in the sky. But it's worth pointing out that by the end of December, when there was a tragic bridge collapse that is also associated with the Mothman, there were many reports of UFOs being published in the local newspapers, and this went on for quite a while after Mothman seemed to have kind of faded out of the scene. Now, excuse me, John Keel had drawn an alliance with a local newspaper reporter named Mary Heyer, who lived in Point Pleasant, and she was really in tune with the pulse of the community, and she and John Keel would go out to the TNT area a lot, and they apparently saw a lot of these lights in the sky, and spoke to many other local people who had seen these as well. So seems to be some type of connection. You know, exactly what type of connection would be pure speculation on my point, but it's definitely worth noting that you know, Mothman and UFOs seem to be linked in some way.
And they're not the only flying humanoid that has that connection, are they?
Not at all. In fact, there are cases from around the world where these flying humanoid creatures have been seen in conjunction with UFOs, or also in areas where UFOs have been seen. So, you know, I guess people can draw their own conclusion from that. You know, the obvious thing that you would maybe want to jump out and say right away is, well, they're extraterrestrials. Well, you know, I'm not going to say that for, you know, I'm not sure that anyone actually saw, or there, you know, there were not very many cases where people actually saw these creatures coming out of UFOs, if at all. So
that also assumes that UFOs are extraterrestrial.
Well, you know, absolutely. You know, as you know, Soraya, there's so many different theories, you know, within the field of the unexplained and Freudian phenomenon. But you know, what we don't have is very much physical evidence of anything. So everything is based on eyewitness accounts, anecdotal evidence and inference. So you can't say anything definitively, I don't think, but you know, it is worth just kind of putting all of the information together and taking a broad look at it.
And how did you go about weeding out the reports that you felt weren't legitimate? Like what kind of criteria did you use?
Well, you know, honestly, I can't say that I weeded out too much. I tried to focus on the more well-known cases, you know, particularly cases that had multiple eyewitnesses. I think that's always important. Mm-hmm. You know, when you have that corroborating evidence of several eyewitnesses experiencing something together, that's very compelling in terms of one person telling you something. I think some of the more dubious cases that I write about in the book don't really pertain to the Mothman, but other similar creatures that were described, you know, in the latter or mid to latter part of the 18th century, from the 19th century up until the early part of the 20th century, when newspaper articles, as I point out in the book, were rather fanciful and, you know, oftentimes, you know, a little hard to swallow. So I can't say. I mean, they were published in newspapers, but, you know, I think it's well known at this point that newspaper publishers in bygone eras would often, you know, they their main concern was selling newspapers, and if they could come up with sort of a fantastic story or spin something a little bit, they would do that. So I think once you start getting into the latter part of the 20th century, you know, we can certainly put a lot more credibility into newspaper accounts at that point.
Okay, and the book contains, I mean, so many different variations of flying humanoids. Some of them are actually humans with wings. Some are more monstrous but in humanoidish form. And some of them are just humans without wings or anything that just seem to be levitating. With such a wide variety of creatures, do you think this is all spawning from one thing? Or do you think that these are all individual, separate things?
Well, that's a great question, and it was, you know, it was actually a very frustrating part of writing the book, because as a cryptozoologist, you know, and I should point out that things like Mothman are and flying humanoids are not, they don't really stem from traditional cryptozoology. Traditional cryptozoology is based on zoology and the fossil history and the natural world and things that are known about the natural world. And I think Mothman kind of falls into a separate category along with, you know, things like werewolves and mermaids and creatures that are almost too fabulous to be real. You know, but that being said, it's very frustrating as a researcher like myself to not be able to come up with any definitive patterns. I mean, that's something you really look for in terms of any type of research, is you want some consistencies there. And, you know, using, for example, things like Bigfoot or Sasquatch as an example, there are very consistent reports of creatures like Bigfoot from all over the world. And you find a pattern of regularity as far as those descriptions go. But as you pointed out, with the flying humanoids, it's kind of a mixed bag. Other than the Mothman, where you had a lot of reports of that are fairly consistent, you do have these gargoyle-type creatures. You have, as you mentioned, these flying human-like beings that are, you know, I refer to in the book as aeronauts, because they almost seem to be like, you know, man-like creatures that are wearing uniforms and just kind of using jetpacks or flying around in the sky uninhibited. So the Jersey Devil. So, you know, there's many different things that we kind of put together in the book, and I really had no other good reason to do that other than they all seem to share certain characteristics as far as being, you know, somewhat humanoid in form, you know, and also being airborne. So, you know, but that was really the only way that I could compile the data, because that was, you know, that was the data that was available to me. So
now some of these aeronauts, as you said, some look like they have jetpacks, but some of them look like they have nothing connected to them, don't they?
Yeah, that's what's interesting about them. And, you know, most of these have been, in fact, several of them have been videotaped down in Mexico by UFO researchers and people that just happen to have video cameras handy. Now, they're very, very high up in the air, so it's hard to make out any great detail as far as these videos go. But, you know, with most of them, you can make out what appears to be a man-like form, a head, two arms sticking out, two legs hanging down. And they're just kind of flying or floating high up in the air and moving on a very slow trajectory. So, you know, it's as I point out, in fact, I dedicated a whole chapter to Mexico in the book, because there have been so many of these types of accounts, particularly over the past years or since the turn of this past century. So, you know, but again, the humanoid form and apparently unfettered by gravity. So that was kind of the common denominator I used to tie them into the book.
Yeah, and there are alternative explanations that skeptics throw out there, that these could just be like batches of balloons or hoaxes or something. How do we know they're not?
Well, we don't, and you know, that's the thing. As a researcher, I try to be as objective as possible, and certainly there are things that are explainable, and that's one thing I've found through my years of research, is sometimes you do come up with a fairly practical and logical answer. So, you know, as you mentioned, one theory that people are launching man-shaped balloons or balloon clusters that look man-shaped up into the air is kind of a hoax, or for whatever reason. You know, certainly there's a possibility that some of these could be some type of experimental, you know, government propulsion systems or something that we just don't know about. You know, and I mean, there are probably some other theories out there too that are escaping me at the moment, but we really don't have anything definitive that we can link these beings to. But it's interesting that they really only started appearing, you know, as I said, in the year 2000. We don't have, or I was not able to find really any other cases that are similar, except maybe if you go into UFO lore a little bit and you find accounts of UFO occupants that seem to float out of their craft and abducting people and so forth.
Right, right. You want to get a little into the Owl Man?
Owl Man is one of my favorite things that I've investigated. It's really a bizarre story. It's got a great name, first of all.
Oh, yeah.
You have to admit it. It conjures up all kinds of images. Owl Man is kind of England's version of the Mothman, and a colleague of mine and a good friend, John Downs, has actually written a definitive book just on the Owl Man, because like Mothman, it seems to be a very multifaceted case with a lot of different layers and angles. But Owl Man has been reported primarily from one location, which is the woods near an old church in Cornwall in southern England, right on the coast. And Owl Man is described as being about 5, maybe 6 feet tall, covered in kind of a gray, either gray feathers or gray fur-like covering, winged, of course, and kind of a hideous face with glowing eyes, no beak, but kind of a black grimace or scowl on its face, and pinchers or crab-like claws on its feet. And most of the sightings of the Owl Man occurred in the summer of 1976. And interestingly enough, most of the eyewitnesses of the Owl Man were young women, specifically teenage women. There was one sighting from the 1980s that John Downs uncovered, and potentially more out there, too, that are kind of ambiguous that we haven't been able to track down. But Owl Man is definitely a creepy character, and much like the Mothman, really scared the bejesus out of anyone that saw it.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like that. One of the more famous ones you deal with briefly is the Jersey Devil. And did the Jersey Devil ever fly?
The Jersey Devil does fly sometimes, and the Jersey Devil is kind of an ambiguous name that stems from a region of the state of New Jersey known as the Pine Barrens. And anyone from New Jersey probably knows that the Pine Barrens is this vast, remote area in the southern part of the state, so named because, of course, you have a lot of coniferous pine trees and not a lot else going on out there. Apparently, agriculture was never developed in that area because the soil's not that good, so it's a pretty remote, wooded area. The Jersey Devil is one of the great figures in the annals of American folklore. It's the traditional description is a winged creature standing about 3 or 4 feet tall with a kangaroo-shaped body, a long muzzle like a horse or a dog, and bat-like wings, and also this long snake-like tail with a fork on the end, kind of like a devilish tail. And the Jersey Devil has been around for centuries in that area, the legends of the Jersey Devil. In fact, it was originally known as the Leeds Devil, dating back to the 1700s. Most of the sightings of the Jersey Devil occurred in a short time span in the year 1909. In January of 1909, there was literally a case of a mass hysteria, as many, many reports of the Jersey Devil were published in local newspapers, and people were very terrified. There have been sporadic reports throughout the years, but the Jersey Devil seems to take different forms. Some people have described it as not being winged. Some of my friends who investigate Bigfoot up in that area claim that Bigfoot creatures have been coined the Jersey Devil and so forth. But people always want to ask me about the Jersey Devil because I just think, again, it's just a great, great legend in American lore.
It's also like the ultimate mixing of different animal parts.
Yeah, it's truly a chimera, you know, a mishmash of different animal parts and things that we would not expect to find. And there's a great story behind it. Apparently, there was a woman known as Mother Leeds back in the early 1700s, and she lived in that area. And she had 12 children and had been abandoned by her husband. So when she found out she was pregnant with her 13th child, she essentially cursed it. And it was born on a stormy night. And in front of all of these midwives and nurses who were present, this thing came out and basically turned into a monster and flew out the window. And it's many people do associate the Jersey Devil with calamities and you know, very negative energy, you know, just negative events, much like the Mothman and some of these other flying humanoids as well.
All right, we got to take a quick 45-second break. We'll be right back with Ken.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And we're talking tonight with Ken Gerhard, author of most recently Encounters with Flying Humanoids. And you've been on quite a few TV shows, haven't you?
I've been very fortunate, Soraya. I've appeared on about a dozen TV shows since 2006. And so far this year, I've filmed four more. So
wow.
I feel very lucky to have an opportunity to go on television and talk about some of these things. And, you know, really for me, the exciting part is being able to get the information out there and hopefully to open people's minds.
Well, it seems like there's a rising interest in the paranormal and the unknown and stuff over the last couple of decades. And especially with the internet and all the different TV shows has just kind of fueled it, where people are a little more comfortable talking about it and admitting they find it interesting rather than, you know, being shunned.
Oh, I'd say that's absolutely true. But, you know, I think things are cyclical. You know, all things in life are cyclical. So
right.
When I was really getting into this stuff back in the 1970s, that seemed like people were very interested. At that time, there were a lot of books coming out and, you know, Edgar Casey and Atlantis and the Bermuda Triangle and UFOs. It was all kind of in the news and very popular. And then maybe throughout the 80s and 90s, it kind of faded a little bit. But you're right. Over the past decade or so, it seems like interest in the paranormal and other inexplicable events has really taken off. I know the field of cryptozoology has gotten very popular as well, which I think is really fabulous.
Tell everyone about the Bat Squatch. That one I found really interesting.
Bat Squatch. Well, that's a great name too. That might rival the Owl Man. Bat Squatch, of course, is a play on the name Sasquatch, which refers to the hairy giants that have been reported up in the Pacific Northwest. Reason being is that Bat Squatch was encountered, and there's only one encounter that we know of. Was encountered near Tacoma, Washington. And there was a young man named Brian Canfield back in April of 1994. He was driving on a deserted mountain road, and I guess that makes sense, and anyone that drives on deserted mountain roads should be prepared to run into something at some point. But according to this young man, he was driving along and suddenly his car engine died, and he lost all his power and he was stranded out in the middle of nowhere. And then things got really weird because suddenly he noticed this massive winged creature descending from the sky in front of his car and landing in the road. And he watched this thing for a few minutes, and they kind of had a staring contest. And according to Brian, this creature was about 9 feet tall, very massive and bulky and hairy, much like the Sasquatch. But it also had bat-like wings kind of folded up against its back, and a long muzzle kind of reminded him of a wolf with pointy ears, sharp teeth, and yellow crescent-shaped eyes. And after a few minutes, this creature took off into the air again, and a few minutes later, Brian regained power to his car and trucked on home at jet speed, I can only imagine, and was quite hysterical when his parents encountered him when he came in the door. So quite a remarkable story, but it's very compelling that he actually contacted the local police and they interviewed him and they found him to be very credible. So,
and one of the interesting things about that is his car lost power, which is something you hear a lot in UFO encounters, but no, I haven't heard it a lot in monster encounters, at least not as much.
Well, that's true. And, I'm probably not intelligent enough to explain this, Soraya, but, I have many friends that are into different aspects of the paranormal and as it relates to physics and things like frequencies, mm-hmm. and energy and, all of these kind of scientific and yet cosmic occurrences. And, of course, UFOs have often been associated with power failures and things like that. Magnetic fields, perhaps one theory. We can talk about vortexes if you like. That's something that people are often mentioned to me, that there are certain locations around the world that have, perhaps window areas or energy sources and things like that. So it's, I can't really give you a definitive answer, which is what kind of makes it all fun. But there are many, many, many possibilities.
But it just brings up another connection to the whole UFO thing as well. Since you brought up window areas, these different reports, as you mentioned earlier, happen in different areas. And a lot of these areas are also UFO hotspots and stuff, or have other paranormal events associated with them. Your thoughts as to maybe why?
I'm sorry, sir. I said it one more time.
Well, why do you think there are certain areas of the Earth that are more likely to have these encounters than other areas?
Well, that's a good question. But, I guess putting it in scientific terms, I would say, and this sounds kind of mundane, but, why are some climates more apt to have rainfall than others? There are just certain characteristics that make up different places in terms of creating the right conditions, so to speak, for things to occur.
That's fair.
We have tornadoes in flat areas and so forth. And I'm not trying in any way to liken the flying humanoid phenomenon to weather related events.
Right. No, but I get what you're saying.
But yeah, but there's, for example, where the Owlman has been sighted in the southern Cornwall, there, that's kind of a window area. You've had sightings of sea serpents right off the coast. And what I found out when researching the Owlman was that this old church known as Mount Ann Church, where the Owlman has been sighted or sighted around, is actually built on an old earthwork that has been there for, Lord knows how long. So perhaps, back in the day, it was kind of a centralized location of worship or given some type of spiritual significance or significance, period, by the people that lived in that area. Point Pleasant, West Virginia, of course, home of the Mothman, has been pointed out, is at the conflux of two major rivers. And I think when you get into Fortean phenomenon and things like cryptozoology, you find out there are a lot of sightings of things near water. The water seems to have a great significance, and it makes sense from the natural fact that it's there's an energy there. Water is a flowing energy source, something that is alive, so to speak. So, again, many different theories, and something else we talk about in the book is, how does the phenomenon of flying humanoids and other related phenomenon, how does that relate to us as humans? Are we somehow, do we somehow give these things life? Are they manifestations of, from our unconscious minds,
right,
thought projections of some kind, or do we somehow channel them, through our perceptions or through our place in the universe? So, very cosmic stuff. And again, a little bit out of my element in terms of a cryptozoologist, because I'm typically the kind of guy that just likes to go out into the woods and look for tracks and blood and hair and things that I can put in my little plastic baggie and take back to a laboratory. So these are all very, very intangible concepts, but very, very, very thought-provoking, very stimulating.
Well, I've always wondered if what we're seeing when we have these encounters, we're seeing something that our brain simply doesn't have any recognition of. Like it has nothing to compare it to, in a sense. And so it puts a face on it, because it has to put something on it. And then once that face has been reported, other people use that face when they see this thing, whatever it really is. You know, like say it's an energy burst, but that energy burst can't be seen as what it is to us because we have no relevance to it.
That's interesting. And, you know, it's been pointed out, for example, that the UFO occupants, you know, that they've kind of evolved or changed over mm-hmm. time, and that they might somehow be related to, you know, the fairy lore, you know, where you right. have all these little beings in different folklores around the world, and then suddenly the classic gray alien with the giant head and the giant eyes that kind of appeared in the early 1970s, you know, with the Barney Betty Hill case and things like that. So, and we're kind of coming full circle here, Soraya, because it goes back to John Keel, and, you know, he kind of, I think, summarized the phenomenon probably better than anyone else, and he basically referred to an ultra-terrestrial intelligence, and he jokingly referred to it, you know, as a cosmic joker.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's some kind of force or phenomenon in our universe that manifests in different ways, and I guess in one fell swoop could explain all types of phenomenon, from Bigfoot and UFOs to spiritual, you know, ghost activity, hauntings, and so forth, that maybe all of these things are related somehow. But basically, they change, you know, based on the perception of the people that are experiencing it.
Yeah. And I mean, that was also the name of, I think, his third book, was it? Disneyland of the Gods was kind of a take on that.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
So, I think one of the cases where you actually got to interview one of these witnesses was the one in Mexico with the flying witch. Am I right on that?
Yeah, that was kind of a very profound experience. We interviewed a police officer named Leonardo Samaniego, and back in 2004, he was on patrol just south of Monterrey, Mexico, in a little suburb known as Guadalupe, when, according to him, something floated down from the sky. This was late at night, and he at first couldn't make out what it was. It was just a large, dark form. But as he watched it, it apparently was a what he described as a witch, or in Spanish, he called it a bruja. Basically, a hideous woman with dark skin and giant black lidless eyes, claws, and she was wearing what appeared to be kind of a black hooded cloak. And she was floating off the ground, and he was terrified, so he threw his car into reverse and began to back away, and this thing flew onto the hood of his car and began clawing at him aggressively through his windshield. And this was more than poor Leonardo could bear, so he actually passed out and was discovered a few minutes later by responding EMT workers and other police officers. Was interviewed for the local TV channels and taken to the local hospital to be examined, and doctors there found that he was of sound mind and was not in any way intoxicated or under the influence of anything else. So I had an opportunity to interview Leonardo, you know, five years after the fact. He's still working at the police force there, and he was actually still visibly shaken by his experience. At several points throughout the interview, he broke down and began to weep, talk about the fact that he still has horrible nightmares of this figure. And so, you know, there's no denying that he and other people that have encountered these beings are affected in a very profound and traumatic way.
And that's one of the interesting things. The after effects of these encounters, if people were making them up, they'd have to have really done some research to know how someone might react to something like this, but it's not a normal reaction.
No, not at all. I mean, you know, some of the people that I have gotten to know and interview that have had these experiences are impacted in, you know, a way that's probably very difficult for any of us to conceive. You know, we certainly, many of your listeners have an interest in the unexplained. Some have probably had experiences with the unexplained, but, you know, if you're not asking for it to happen, so to speak, if you're not seeking it out and it happens to you, and you know, it's kind of one of those things that can really shake the foundation of your reality. You know, if you don't have the answers and you're not sure what's going on. So, I think it's worth pointing out, now that we're on this subject, you know, I think some of the cases back in the days before the internet, where people would actually go to the police and file a report, that they were that terrified and that upset, or that fearful, that they would actually go to the police. I mean, that's really sticking your neck out there, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you're suddenly, you know, you're going on public record. Many of these people ended up in the newspaper and probably got a lot of unwanted attention.
Yeah.
In this day and age, it's very, very easy for people to go onto a website and post kind of an anonymous report of, well, I saw this and so forth. And I'm certainly not implying that some of those people didn't have those experiences, but I don't think it's as riveting as those people that back in the day actually went to the police and went to the newspapers and reported these experiences and suffered the consequences.
And some of these people seem to go through almost like a post-traumatic stress syndrome, don't they?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the more rewarding aspects of what I do is when I have someone reach out to me that's had an encounter with something inexplicable and you know, they're understandably seeking answers, and typically I can't provide any, but I do my very best to kind of act as a counselor and you know, to reaffirm that other people have had similar experiences and that these things do happen.
Yeah.
And so, you know, whenever I have an opportunity to help somebody get a little bit of closure, that's very rewarding.
Okay. You want to tell people about, I love this one, the Floating Goblins of Hopkinsville, Kentucky.
Oh, well, anyone who's a fan of UFOs and ufology is probably familiar with the case of the yeah. Kelly Hopkinsville Goblins, a very, very famous case in the field of UFOs. And I decided to include it in my book because it did share some attributes with some of the other flying humanoid cases, and specifically the fact that the creatures involved were said to be able to float through the air sort of freely. But Kelly is a small hamlet near the small town of Hopkinsville, Kentucky, which is in a very remote rural wooded area in Kentucky. And back in 1955, there was a family that was staying out on this farm, and one gentleman had stepped outside after dinner to fetch some water, and he saw this large object, kind of a glowing object, descend behind a hill nearby. And he came in the house and was rather upset. And people in the house thought that maybe he had seen a shooting star or something else. But then within a few minutes, they were actually, this farmhouse was approached by this small creature that was later described as a goblin. It was kind of a metallic silver color with giant ears and giant eyes, just a little slit for a mouth, and kind of a massive upper body, but very weak and withered legs. And it's kind of funny, when it was approaching the house, it was holding its arms straight up in the air, almost as if it was surrendering. But Lucky Sutton, who was the patriarch of the household, went outside with a shotgun and began firing at this thing, and it kind of floated away unharmed. And over the course of the night, several of these goblin-like creatures began popping up around the farmhouse on the rooftop in tree branches, and they seemed to be impervious to the gunshots. And basically, I think the way I describe it in the book, there was like a little mini War of the Worlds going on. So, but after a few hours of this, the Sutton family couldn't take it anymore, and they piled into two cars and sped into town to get the police. And the event was investigated by the local police. I think a dozen officers responded that night, and in addition, the U.S. military took an active interest in the case as well, and they sent out some investigators and some military people as well. So, great story. And there were some children who were present there at the time, and most of them were kind of cowered under the bed, but they're adults now, and some of them have been interviewed, and you know, they were obviously very traumatized by the entire event. They didn't all get a good look at these goblin-like creatures, but their parents did. And again, we have a case with many corroborating witnesses that something really remarkable happened on this farm in Kelly, Kentucky, back in 1955.
Yeah, for some reason I'm thinking that did they do like flips when they got shot or something, and then just kind of come?
Yeah, they would flip over backwards and kind of, you know, one of them they shot out of a tree. You know, it was high up on a tree branch, and they shot it and just kind of floated to the ground and so forth. So. Kind of comical, and you know, one of the more absurd explanations that was offered was that basically they encountered some escaped monkeys that had been spray painted silver. So I thought that was perhaps even a tad more bizarre than the other theories that were put forward.
That totally explains everything. When Mothman and some of these things are brought up, some people will point to the Garuda legend, and you get into that very briefly in your book. Do you want to tell people about that a little?
Well, Garuda is a great figure in Hindu and Buddhist lore, and Garuda is a giant winged being, very spiritual being, sometimes perceived as a savior, sometimes as an omen or a harbinger of important events, and there is an appendix in the book where I kind of look at a lot of the old folklores and mythologies around the world of similar creatures like Garuda. Now, Garuda was a name that was kind of adopted again by John Keel, and he kind of referred to it a lot. But you know, if you look at the ancient Sumerians, they had these creatures known as the Apkallu or Abgal. In the Americas, the Maya worshipped a creature known as the Kamazots or Zots, the death bats. Japan had the Tengu. Europe has a variety of creatures, the Gwrachrybin, which is Welsh, and the Scree of Scotland. And, you know, even in some of the islands of Indonesia, you have things like the Papabawa, the Orang Bati. So you have all of these kind of similar legends and mythologies around the world that I think got a lot of credibility to the flying humanoid phenomenon, because it doesn't seem to be a recent invention. If you go back and look at these different legends around the world from very diverse cultures, there seems to be a foundation there that would indicate that this has been going on for thousands of years.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, skeptics a lot of times will throw out things like, well, these are just large birds that are misidentified, but that doesn't really fit most of these encounters, does it?
Well, you know, certainly there's always going to be a small percentage of cases where people have misinterpreted events and perhaps let their imaginations run wild a little
bit.
But, you know, with regard to the majority of cases that I cover in the book, I think there's no denying that what people have seen does not easily fit into any category or classification of any known creature. Birds, even very large birds, are fairly recognizable by people almost instantaneously. They have characteristics that we recognize immediately. Feathers, obviously, and beaks, and, you know, the largest known birds, which would be the Andean condors, are really, they're big and they're impressive when you see them up close, but nowhere approaching the size and scale of a man or a humanoid. So I would understand why the skeptics would say that. And again, I would say that, you know, there might be some cases that could pertain to that. But by and large, I think that we're dealing with something entirely different.
Yeah, yeah. Well, especially when you're encountering something like the bat squatch, I don't think you can easily dismiss that as a large bird. Or the witch encounter.
Not at all.
Or the witch flying witch encounter in Mexico, you know. You'd have to be really, really off to even begin to identify one of those things as a large bird.
Well, not at all. But, you know, I will, you know, again, trying to be as objective as possible and from a skeptical point of view, there are cases where people are capable of hallucinating.
Sure.
There are theories. There are theories of mass hallucination and the power of suggestion. There are people that are flat out demented, and you know, I'm certainly not implying that with regard to any of the people in my book, because I felt that all of those cases had substantial amount of credibility. So, but people do make mistakes and people do misinterpret things. And so we could discount some of the cases, I guess.
Right, right. Well, it's also possible that maybe certain areas, these hot spots, affect us in a way to create a hallucination. Maybe it releases more DMT into our system, and then we enter that altered state of consciousness, and that's where we're encountering these things, which also would explain the lack of physical evidence as well.
Well, that's a great statement that you just made. And, I can say for a fact, I've seen people become overly excited in certain situations when they, there have been suggestions that something remarkable is happening. And, I have to admit that when I first traveled into Point Pleasant, I perceived a certain type of electricity in the air. But I can't help but wonder if some of that was perhaps not my excitement at finally being in this really, amazing place where all of these events had transpired years ago that I'd read about. So certainly there is a psychological component that can't be discounted.
Yeah, and you had some interesting synchronicities going there, didn't you?
I did. I had some interesting synchronicities, and again, I'm very skeptical about this. I was kind of concerned about getting into the subject matter in the first place because there is a allegation of a Mothman curse that different people become involved in the Mothman investigation have met with tragic demise. John Downs, who I mentioned earlier, when he was writing his Owlman book, he felt that all these negative things were happening to him. He called it psychic backlash. In my own particular case, I met several people from Point Pleasant. I met two people from Point Pleasant about a week before I headed up there, and this was in South Texas, thousands of miles from Point Pleasant. And it should be pointed out that Point Pleasant is actually to this day still a very small town. I think the population is only like 3,000 people or something. And when I was flying up to Point Pleasant to film the TV show, I was sitting on an airplane next to a gentleman that, once we had struck up a conversation, I found out that he was actually from Point Pleasant and that one of his childhood friends had died in the tragic collapse of the Silver Bridge, which is often associated with Mothman. So little things like that, they make you wonder.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Now, as you said earlier, you were looking for some patterns to all of this stuff. You did find a couple of patterns in some of the witnesses, didn't you?
Well, several of the eyewitnesses who encountered Mothman, for example, claim that they had developed psychic abilities. I don't know if that's what you're referring to specifically, but Linda Scarberry, who we talked about earlier, and also a woman named Martella Bennett, both of whom were interviewed by Andy Colvin years later, claimed that they had developed kind of premonitions, I guess, that they had premonitions about different events, things like that.
And that happens too with UFO witnesses, where they start to develop psychic abilities and have other paranormal things happen to them after they have a UFO encounter.
Well, that's true. Yeah, and I'm sorry. Am I missing something? What else?
You were also pointing out that a lot of the cases involved females, especially young females.
Oh yeah. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
There's so many different angles. That I wrote about. That's true. Most of the reports that I collected, I think the majority of reports in the book were by female eyewitnesses, and many of them very young. Many, many cases of young people, and I don't think this would come as a surprise to anyone out there who's interested in the unexplained, because we've always kind of theorized and speculated, many people in the field, that young people, of course, they have a very different perception. Because they have not developed, they've not been influenced to the point, like an old codger like myself, we sort of develop filters as we get older, and we learn to disregard things, or we tend to disregard things, I should say, simply because they don't fit into the framework of what our experience is, where they've brought us. But young people, of course, are very open, and they see the world you know, through completely different eyes, and so that, you know, perhaps that they are able to perceive things that we are not as we get older. So
you also speculate a little that they're trying to scare people, that whatever these things are, they're trying to almost feed off the negative energy they're creating.
Well, you know, for example, the Mothman. There are several accounts of Mothman chasing people, chasing their cars, but it never actually catches them. You know, it just kind of, you know, and oftentimes it kind of veers off or disappears at the last second. And you know, this is true in some other flying humanoid cases as well. So again, there does seem to be a recurring theme where these creatures will chase people or terrify people, but never actually physically, you know, have any contact with them.
Right.
So to me, that kind of implies that these creatures are somehow drawn to our fear, or perhaps given some type of life by our fear. And I know that's kind of just a wild theory, but that's
sure.
Really the only thing that I was able to come up with as to why they would behave that way.
And David Weatherly has said much the same thing about the black-eyed children, that he feels that they may actually be feeding off of people's fear. So maybe there's a connection there too.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's again, it's a recurring theme, not only in cryptozoology, but, you know, other aspects of the unexplained and Freudian phenomenon, where different types of entities or beings or apparitions seem to be like psychic vampires. They feed off of our emotions and our energy. That it really gives them kind of a life.
Yeah. All right. Have you had any reports of encounters since you published the book?
I actually had one really remarkable report that I received from a gentleman out in West Texas named Trey Austin, and I've interviewed him on the phone several times at length, and he seems to be a very credible person. And what he told me was that back in September of last year, I'm sorry, rewind, September of 2012, he and his wife were out in their backyard in a place called Big Spring, Texas, one night, presumably a starlit night, and they had pretty good visibility. And in the distance, they saw something approaching them through the air. At first, they thought it was a very large bird, but as it got closer and closer, much to their horror and chagrin, they could make out a man-like form, and it literally passed right over their heads, you know, only about maybe 20 yards up. And according to Trey, this figure would have stood about 10 to 14 feet tall.
Wow.
Man-like face, long flowing hair, very pronounced facial features, high cheekbones, kind of a chiseled look, feet, and very large black wings that look feathered or almost angelic types of wings. And this thing looked down at them ominously and just kind of flew overhead. So I was not able to include that particular report in the book because it had already kind of gone off to the publisher. But I thought that was quite a remarkable situation.
Yeah, yeah.
Description.
What do you have plans to do next?
Oh, gosh. Too many things. I have a few television appearances that'll be coming up later this year. Just got done filming. I really can't talk about those too much, but
okay.
Hopefully people that are watching some of these different programs on The Unexplained will catch me on there. Just started writing a new book, finally. It usually takes me a while to put a book together, so I figured I'd start as soon as possible this time, and maybe there won't be as long a gap.
And what's the new book going to be on?
The new book is going to be kind of a potpourri of, or mixed bag of, different things that I've investigated, a variety of different mystery creatures, everything from, you know, Bigfoot-like creatures to werewolves to lake monsters, esoteric things like giant insects.
Hmm.
So, you know, it's an homage to some of my the early books in the field of cryptozoology back in the early 1940s, 50s, when people like Bernard Heuvelmans and Ivan Sanderson were writing these books of, you know, that basically ran the gamut of different things. So I kind of wanted to do something in that spirit.
Nice. Okay. And this book is currently available on Amazon, correct?
Yes, it's available on Amazon. It's available at Barnes & Noble online, and also at all Barnes & Noble locations. So people, if they don't want to buy online, they can shoot down to the local Barnes & Noble, and you should be able to find it in the metaphysical unexplained section. But it's online at major online book retailers, too, and there's also an e-book slash Kindle-type format available for download as well.
Okay. Can people find your other two books on Amazon and such as well?
My other books are probably best found on Amazon.com, and okay. I think if you go in there and just type in my name, Ken Gerhard, the link should take you to all of my books.
Okay, and where can people find you online?
Well, the best place is probably my website, which I just did a soft launch after many months of of trying to put it together. But KenGerhard.com is my website. People can get in touch with me there. There are also links to my books, to some of my blogs that I've written, and some photos as well. And I'm hoping to add more content there in the coming weeks and months. And I also have a Facebook fan page, Ken Gerhard Cryptozoologist. And people can get in touch with me there as well. And I also have a lot of my posts and articles, research, photos, videos, all types of things up there.
All right. Well, I thank you so much, Ken. And to anyone who finds this interesting, I highly recommend the book, Encounters with Flying Humanoids. We've been talking with Ken Gerhard. And up next is The Last Exit for the Lost. If you're listening live, otherwise, we will see you next week.
Shut the closet door, it's under the floor, the monster's there. Don't leave me here among these ghosts. You promised me nightmares the day I was born. You promised me hellfire, you were so sure. I grew up waiting for demons. Of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Burn me, chew me, slake me, thrill me. I don't want the unicorn. I want the bloodsucker. Modify the uniform, cause I'm a monster. The situation is evolving. I don't know if you are lying out of spite, or if you wish me to. Sick of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Bind me, chill me, slake me, thrill me. This is a sound I've heard before. It's like a voice asking for more. Ma chère éclate à cause des ailes. En grand spectacle de primavera. Give me the night. Death doesn't scare me. I want the vampires and I want the glory. Now ammunition, give me an Armageddon. Give me the daring to forfeit ordinary dreams for the cost of pleasing humans far too steep. Give me the nightmares, cause death doesn't scare me.